books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on this festive edition of the show, we'll have some interactive live Dungeons and Dragons. We'll find both Christmas books and brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books library. And Michael Marpurgo himself will be telling us about his Tales from Shakespeare. All that on today's Read On. Let's start off the show by visiting the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. John le Carré's Son has returned to the George Smiley series. Carla's Choice is by Nick Harkaway, donated by Penguin Random House.
Crossing Primrose Hill on her way to the offices of Banerty and Clay, where her employer Mr. Banerty presided over the careers of London's less dazzling literary stars, Susanna Yarrow had the instinct that London was only now waking from a deep winter sleep. In the yellow windows of flats and houses along the lower edge of the hill, she could see people setting about the day. Low above St. Pancras, the sun was doing its best. Her mother would have called it adequate, which was her favourite damnation. Many things were adequate, and none of them was any better than this Monday morning. She turned towards Ormond Terrace, shortening her stride. This was the price of walking to the top of the hill for the view. You had to come down again, along the slurried path, which was perilous even in flat shoes. She kept her head over her feet and spread her arms, hoping no one was looking out of the terrace windows and comparing her with the penguins half a mile away in London Zoo. She had walked to school in snow every winter for the first half of her life. She would not now be defeated by mud.
It is spring in 1963, and George Smiley has left the circus. With the wreckage of the West's spy war with the Soviets strewn across Europe, he has eyes only on a more peaceful life. And indeed, with his marriage more secure than ever, there's a rumour in Whitehall, unconfirmed and a little scandalous, that George Smiley might almost be happy. But control has other plans. A Russian agent has defected in the most unusual of circumstances, and the man he was sent to kill in London is nowhere to be found. Smiley reluctantly agrees to one last simple task. Interview Susanna, a Hungarian migrant, an employee of the missing man, and sniff out a lead. But in his absence, the shadows of Moscow have lengthened. Smiley will soon find himself entangled in a perilous mystery that will define the battles to come and strike at the heart of his greatest enemy. Set in the missing decade between two iconic installments in the George Smiley saga, Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Carla's Choice is an extraordinary, thrilling return to the world of spy fiction's greatest writer, John le Carré.
When she reached the office, she expected to find Mr. Banerty at his desk, which was the one in the centre, her own to the left and the third to the right. Instead, the door was locked, and she had to open up and turn on the lights, which made her immediately uncomfortable. Mr. Banerty woke early, the army, he had told her, and performed a series of ludicrous exercises devised by a Swiss. Then he drank coffee, ate whatever they sent from the bakery on the high street, and read books, mostly submissions from new writers hoping for representation. The office was as prim and tidy as the postbag was immense. There was an old English woman called Wright who came late three nights a week to dust, with an actual scarf tied on top of her head in the classic style. By the time Susanna arrived each morning, there was always a stack of discarded typescripts on the right side of his desk for repatriation, and very occasionally one on the left side for her attention. The two piles would be separated by the 8x10-inch portrait photograph that was his only personal affectation. It showed a boy and a woman, the print older than the modern frame, and its presence indicated a kind of punctuation mark in his discussion with himself. "I have done this work. I have arrived at this point, and now I may rest. But only for a short time, because literature never sleeps."
Carla's Choice by Nick Haraway is read by Simon Russell Beale and runs for 10 hours and 43 minutes.
Last Boy of 66, My Story of England's World Cup Winning Team, is by Jeff Hurst.
I'm sitting in a cafe when a text comes through from my granddaughter, Grace. She has a question for me. "Were you still playing for West Ham when you did the World Cup final?" Grace is 15, and she's working on a project at school. The brief is to interview an adult about a key event in their life, to ask a series of detailed questions about the impact it has had on them. She's already put most of them to me face to face. It was quite a grilling. But now she's after a bit more background information. "Some facts." "Yes," I text back. Grace knows something about the big event in my life, but it's hardly her fault that she's unfamiliar with a few of the basics.
Jeff wanted to get down his final thoughts about 1966. He talks about Alf Ramsey, his vision, his drive, his loyalty, also his shyness, even awkwardness. About his teammates, about Jimmy Greaves, hard workers, cool heads, dedicated pros. Jeff tells their collective story, digging below the surface, reflecting on their victory, its impact on their lives. It was a bittersweet onward journey for the boys of 66. Their legacy was squandered and their team uncelebrated. But the 11 of them shared something that no other Englishman has ever experienced. And here Jeff brings them all together one last time to see them make history.
"I have been blessed with 5 grandchildren. At the time of writing, they ranged from 35 all the way down to 7. Despite that considerable age span, I hope there's one thing they would all agree on. Their grandpa doesn't spend his precious time with them bending their ear with tales of yesteryear from before they were born. Or in Grace's case, from long before her mother was born. But yes, I did play for West Ham United back then. Famously, so did a couple of my teammates on that historic day. It was Hammers who scored the goals. All 4 of them. Another Hammer, the very best of us, set up the first and the last. West Ham 4, West Germany 2. Another text arrives. "And who asked you to play for the England team? Or how did you get onto the England team?" "Alf Ramsey," I reply. "Alf Ramsey picked me." Many people know these things. They know that Alf Ramsey was knighted for his achievement. They know he sent out a team that was dubbed the Wingless Wonders. And in their sleep, they can reel off the names of those 11 players. But there are younger generations who, even if they know who managed England, don't know much more. About his vision, his drive, his loyalty, also his shyness, even awkwardness, and his unease with the press.
Last Boy of 66, My Story of England's World Cup Winning Team, by Jeff Hurst, is read by Jeff Hurst and Robert Farley, and runs for 8 hours and 44 minutes. One of the highlights of Christmas at school was the fact you could bring in games. Well, Read On is no different. In the RNIB Library now, you can join a troupe of professional actors for a madcap audio adventure based on the popular role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. Recorded at live shows in London and featuring randomised character names and improvisation, It's Your Role, R-O-L-E, is a funny, fantastical introduction to D&D. 2 introductory episodes are available in the library right now, which introduce the characters you'll be hearing in the series. Episode 1 is called Enter the Tiger. Episode 2 is called Wood from the Trees. Here's how they're introduced.
Hello, and welcome to Session Zero, the first ever of It's Your Role of the Improvised D&D Adventure.
Ooh.
With me, Elliot Reeves-Giblin, your Dungeon Master.
And me, Max Jukes, who will be playing Sun Lao Hun in the show.
So, just before we do our little old soiree, our little old show at Riverside Studios, and we're in London, we thought it'd be good for you guys to get to know the characters a bit. So we'll be having a little short half an hour adventure with each of the player characters, kind of telling you what they're about, where they've been, where they're going, and what they want, really. Does that sound good to you, Max?
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Fantastic.
It's going to be great.
Fantastic.
Joining me is Elliot Reeves-Giblin, one of the performers and co-creator of It's Your Role, to tell me more. How are you today?
I'm very well, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about It's Your Role.
Yeah, so I'm obviously mates with a bunch of actors. We love Dungeons & Dragons. We've been playing it for ages. And we just thought, well, wouldn't it be good if we kind of brought an audience along with us on this?
Oh. I'll jump down with a little backflip off of the pagoda to land, sort of like hero landing, three-point landing.
Unbelievable.
I'll put my flute away and I'll walk down to meet this person.
Fantastic. Well, as you do all of that, you very quickly bump into our first NPC, who is named...
Ooh.
Triskeitha Romeo.
Triskeitha?
Triskeitha.
Triskeitha
Romeo. She's an older wood elf with her hair tied back into quite a severe ponytail that is kept in place with a little wooden branch. A lot of wood elves, you know, they keep their youth for years as they are wont to live for hundreds of years. Triskeitha is quite obviously one of the older wood elves in the monastery, considering that even for her youthful appearance, she has some wrinkles just to the side of her eyes, kind of just making those lovely blue and silvery eyes that she has. It just betrays the fact that she's seen some things.
So It's Your Role is like a live theatre experience. It's all improvised and it's really interactive, you know. We get audience members up on stage if they want to to join in the adventure. We also have some of those classic kind of improv games that you might see if you ever went to any kind of improv shows, where we've got funny names out of a hat. We've got the audience sounding instruments to change the kind of the course of the story. So it's just kind of a really fun night out. We're kind of describing it to people as Lord of the Rings meets Whose Line Is It Anyway, if you ever remembered that show.
So you don't have to be into D&D to enjoy it?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, obviously, we are kind of encouraging people who like or have always wanted to play D&D to come along. There are most certainly aspects about the show that they'll get, but it's 100%. Kind of friendly to new people, whether they've always kind of, you know, been strafing around the idea of playing D&D, or just for people who want a fun night out. You know, it's not like we'll be talking in a very dense kind of technical language that they won't understand. It's all very nice and accessible and just a good laugh, to be honest.
You've kind of answered this, but all the other actors are into D&D then?
Yes. So it's basically just all my mates. We're all actors, improvisers and voiceover artists. Quite a few I've met when I've been working on video games. So we're all really into the doing the silly voices and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it'll be all of us on stage and then there'll be that audience member who gets to come up and join in the adventure with us.
But the reason we're talking today is the live performances are being captured and available as a podcast in the RNIB library. How are you going about capturing the performance?
So we've got some really, really cool technical people working on this. We've got Max Jukes, who's our kind of our go-to technical guy, because I'm a bit rubbish with that kind of stuff. He's looked into some really state-of-the-art microphones that we're going to be using on stage. that not only kind of cast our voices into the auditorium so the audience can hear us, but it also records directly for us to upload at a later date. We'll also be having really unique and kind of immersive soundscapes going on during the performance. Those two are going to be captured and put into the podcast as well. So when you're listening to this on the RNIB library, it's not just going to be the voices you'll be hearing, but hopefully you'll be hearing kind of immersive soundscapes. For example, if the adventure ends up going into, you know, a dark kind of primeval forest, then there'll be the sounds of very aggressive owls and wind going through the trees and that kind of thing.
Let's have a listen.
Ah, San Lao. So you're playing your instrument again?
Yes, I've been pondering about the world beyond.
I see. You should really get your head out of the clouds. Although here at the monastery we do encourage the esoteric arts of music playing and meditation, cleansing one's soul through those activities. And she kind of from behind her brings a big bucket filled with hot soapy water. We also encourage the cleaning of the temple floors as well.
Ah, yes, I thought there was probably something I was supposed to be doing.
We can't have you shirking your duties now.
No, I'm sorry, Master Romeo.
And I'll take up the bucket and sort of like gingerly start making my way towards the temple to go do my chores.
Just before you leave, can you give me an insight check?
Can indeed.
Now, we've just heard an example. How different is each show?
Honestly, it couldn't be more different. The show, or basically the story that will be taking place, the adventure that everyone will be going on, will be different every time. So there's a huge amount of replayability as an audience member coming to watch it. And there's also a huge level of replayability in terms of listening to the podcasts. So there'll be a different adventure every time. Our actors will also rotate as well. So there'll always be a new actor in every time with another one taking a night off. And also there'll also be a different audience member every time. So I think we found this already when we've been recording some things already. Is like one show can be a very kind of almost carry-on-esque kind of fantasy adventure, and another one can be quite a dramatic and epic kind of campaign. So honestly, they couldn't be more different, and I think that's kind of part of what makes it so exciting. Most of the adventures are kind of your classic knights in armor, swords, fighting dragons and dungeons, that kind of thing. However, we are looking, once we've kind of got a bit more established, doing themed adventures. You know, your sci-fi stuff, maybe your more themed evenings. We are looking, when it gets close to Christmas and we do a show around then, we are trying to kind of make it work in a kind of fantasy Christmas themed. We haven't quite figured out how that's going to look yet, but hopefully that should be good fun.
Now, as I said, the podcasts are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, but if you want to find out more, or perhaps you're not a member of the library, where could you go?
So you can head over to our social media, which is at It's Your Role Show. We're available wherever you get your social media, and they'll also be on Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts as well.
And we're not sure of the timings here, but if you want to go and see it live, will the dates be on your socials as well?
Yeah, it'll all be on there. So after that first show, we will be having subsequent shows every month. We are aiming for a nice Thursday, Friday or Saturday slot going into the new year. So hopefully we'll have numerous shows that people can come and see. And like I said, it's different every time, completely different vibe, actors, story. So just keep an eye on our socials when we announce those tickets.
Elliot Reeves Giblin, thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Still to come, we'll hear from Michael Morpurgo about his Tales from Shakespeare. But now it's my turn to wander around the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some Christmas books.
A quick search in the RNIB Talking Books Library will turn up many books about Christmas, some dramas, some kids' stories, and some to help you on the big day. So let's start off with
Women's Institute Complete Christmas. Over 130 recipes for a perfect Christmas. Christmas is the time of year for enjoying the company of family and friends. but this can be lost in the frantic lead-up to the big day. I'm sure we've all said it many times, all this fuss over one day. But it's definitely worth the effort. It can be such a bright and happy time with parties and celebrations and a chance to be hospitable. We can indulge in delicious meals without thinking about calories and have a perfect excuse to decorate our homes both inside and out with festive decorations that would be considered over the top at any other time. It's also a great opportunity to get out the best china and tableware to make all the meals extra special.
The Women's Institute Complete Christmas is packed with over 130 fail-safe recipes and ideas for Christmas, from traditional favourites such as butter roast turkey with chestnut stuffing or other festive favourites. And staying in a traditional Christmas mood, here's some Christmas stories by Charles Dickens.
I have been looking on this evening at a merry company of children assembled round that pretty German toy, a Christmas tree. The tree was planted in the middle of a great round table and towered high above their heads. It was brilliantly lighted by a multitude of little tapers, and everywhere sparkled and glittered with bright objects. There were jolly, broad-faced little men, much more agreeable in appearance than many real men, and no wonder, for their heads took off and showed them to be full of sugar plums. There were rosy-cheeked dolls hiding behind the green leaves, and there were real watches, with movable hands at least, and an endless capacity of being wound up, dangling from innumerable twigs.
So he wrote more than A Christmas Carol. This is a collection of short stories written by Dickens, sometimes alone, sometimes in collaboration with Wilkie Collins, for the Christmas numbers of magazines to which he contributed. Now let's bring things a little more up to date. R.D. Wingfield's Frost at Christmas.
10 days to Christmas, and Tracy Uphill, aged 8, hasn't come home from Sunday school. Enter D.I. Jack Frost, sloppy, scruffy, and insubordinate. To help him investigate the case of the missing child, Frost has been assigned a new sidekick, the chief constable's nephew. Fresh to Provincial Denton in an over-smart suit, D.C. Clive Barnard is an easy target for Frost's withering satire. Assisted and annoyed by Barnard, Frost proceeds with the investigation in typically unorthodox style.
R.D. Wingfield's Frost at Christmas, and also more crime at Christmas with the invasion of the Christmas puddings.
The Death Pudding! Doo-doo-doo-doo-doom!
Father Christmas flung the rocket sleigh into a handbrake turn and accelerated hard, but it was useless. The Death Pudding had caught the little sleigh in its extra sticky, sticky matter traction beam and was relentlessly reeling in the rocket. A gaping mouth appeared among the flames on the surface of the Death Pudding as the rocket was sucked inside. As the mouth began to close back down, Father Christmas, peering fearfully from his sleigh, saw what he had most feared all his life. His big, bad brother.
Father Christmas's evil brother, Bad Christmas, is plotting to turn everyone on the planet into zombies using Christmas puddings. The Invasion of the Christmas Puddings by Jeremy Strong is available from RNIB. And staying with Christmas puddings, how about The Adventure of the Christmas Pudding with Hercule Poirot?
Hercule Poirot entered his bedroom. It was a large room, well provided with radiators. As he went over towards the big four-poster bed, he noticed an envelope lying on his pillow. He opened it and drew out a piece of paper. On it was a shakily printed message in capital letters. "Don't eat none of the plum pudding. One as wishes you well." Hercule Poirot stared at it. His eyebrows rose. "Cryptic," he murmured, "and most unexpected."
The Adventure of the Christmas Pudding and a selection of other entrees by Agatha Christie is available in various formats from RNIB. But from murderers at the Christmas table to someone with a heart two sizes too small, here's the meanest creature you'll ever meet.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Dr. Seuss. Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot. But the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small.
The disgruntled Grinch hatches a dastardly plan to steal Christmas from the citizens of Whoville. This short story is available from RNIB Overdrive and in various formats from the National Library Service. Now here's an unusual one you may not have heard of. You'll certainly have heard of the author, famous for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy, but J.R.R. Tolkien also wrote some Father Christmas letters.
1928. What do you think the poor dear old bear has been and done this time? Nothing as bad as letting off all the lights. Only fell from top to bottom of the main stairs on Thursday. We were beginning to get the first lot of parcels down out of the storerooms into the hall. Polar Bear would insist on taking an enormous pile on his head, as well as a whole lot in his arms.
Written by J.R.R. Tolkien to his children, the Father Christmas letters are available from RNIB and in various formats from RNIB's National Library Service. Also, why not try some cat tales for Christmas?
Cat tales for Christmas. What a cosy image. A full moon outside, not a footprint in the snow, the doors well sealed and every window pane rimmed with frost. Beneath the dark oak beams, a quiet figure sits by a log fire. A grandfather clock chimes a late hour, and all eyes look up as she begins to read. At her feet, blinking in the gloaming and purring contentedly as the aged voice unfolds the story, lies the household cat, smiling a quiet approval.
Some vintage, some contemporary cat tales by various authors, available from RNIB. As are these general stories for Christmas.
Stories for Christmas by Alf Prazen. High up on the hillside stood a little town all by itself. The people who lived there were exactly like other people in other towns. Some were tall and some were small. Some were hard working and some were lazy. Some liked fish cakes better than meatballs, and some liked meatballs better than fish cakes. So there were a few differences between them. But in one respect, they were all alike. They were terribly forgetful, and they forgot the most extraordinary things all at the same time.
By Alf Prosen, the stories for Christmas comprise a number of festive tales, like the one where it's Christmas Eve and the whole town had forgotten. Then a little girl looked up at the fir trees in the forest and begins to remember. And finally, Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales.
One Christmas was so much like another in those years around the sea town corner now, and out of all sound, except the distant speaking of voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street, and they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hand into the snow and bring out whatever I can find.
The Talking Book Service from RNIB is free and easy to join. Head to www.rnib.org.uk and click on Talking Books. And we'll be hearing from Michael Marpurgo after this.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books. It's so important for books to be available in audio. Children start off before they can read, don't they? They start off hearing stories, hearing their parents telling stories. And I see audiobooks as being a wonderful continuation of that tradition. I was really shocked when I read that only a quite small percentage of the total number of books that there are available for blind people. And of course, when you want to write a book, you want everyone to get it. You're not trying to write for just the sighted section of the population. I think it's absolutely vital that people who are blind can get the stories.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Michael Morpurgo, OBE, is one of Britain's best-loved writers for children. With sales of over 35 million copies, he's written over 150 books, served as the Children's Laureate, and has won many prizes. Also, as I've spoken to him about on the show before, with his wife Claire, he is the co-founder of Farms for City Children. He was knighted in 2018 for services to literature and to charity. I spoke to him about his book Tales from Shakespeare, retellings of 10 of Shakespeare's plays. And some of the retellings were dramatised by the RSC, introduced by Michael Morpurgo, and are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
This tale is based on The Tempest and tells the story of a powerful magician cast away on some magical island. There are lots of different ways to interpret Shakespeare's plays and characters. My tales from Shakespeare are full of ideas I've had about what I think the characters are like and how the stories should flow, but you might have very, very different ideas, and you might even want to try those out, write them down, see what you can do.
There are many ways to tell a story. And sometimes, it seems to me, there is only one person who should tell it. Especially if that person is at the heart of the story, the architect of it.
And even more especially if the whole story is so impossibly fantastical that otherwise it would be too hard to believe.
Unless the teller was there to witness it and to tell it afterwards.
Prospero was there.
He lived the story, his story.
So, let him tell it. His way.
I am Prospero.
I was born many years ago.
77 now. He's 77 now. He's coming towards the end.
As we all must.
Mm. I have lived a long and strange life. A life full of supreme joys and deep sadnesses. And full of regrets too. I know now that the mistakes we make, the wrongs and cruelties we commit, cannot be undone.
And most importantly, that truth must be told. Mm. Faults must be acknowledged.
It is time now, then, while I still can, to look back on my life, reflect on the good, the bad, and the ugly.
A clip from Michael Morpurgo's Tales from Shakespeare, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. The retelling of Shakespeare's plays in a younger voice is not a new idea. Charles and Mary Lamb published their Tales from Shakespeare in 1807. I'll talk to Michael Morpurgo about the influence of this book in a moment, but for now, let's hear from that book. As I said, it was published in 1807, but a new version of it was recorded with a very familiar voice in 2005.
Tales from Shakespeare by Charles and Mary Lamb.
Told by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres.
Macbeth. When Duncan the Meek reigned king of Scotland, there lived a great thane or lord called Macbeth. This Macbeth was a near kinsman to the king, and in great esteem at court for his valour and conduct in the wars, an example of which he'd lately given in defeating a rebel army assisted by the troops of Norway in terrible numbers. The two Scottish generals, Macbeth and Banquo, returning victorious from this great battle, their way lay over a blasted heath, where they were stopped by the strange appearance of three figures, like women, except that they had beards, and their withered skins and wild attire made them look not like any earthly creatures. Macbeth first addressed them. When they, seemingly offended, laid each one her choppy finger upon her skinny lips in token of silence. And the first of them saluted Macbeth with the title of Thane of Glamis.
Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres reading from Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. When I spoke to Michael Morpurgo, I asked him if we had Charles and Mary Lamb to thank for his new book.
We have, absolutely. Charles and Mary Lamb, who wrote it, I don't know, near 200 years ago, these tales of Shakespeare, which I grew up on. Benedict Cumberbatch grew up on, he wrote the introduction to my book. And I think it was because I became fond of Shakespeare with those two storytellers in the age of six, seven, eight, or no, I went off to the theatre inspired by those stories. So I thought, do it again now, because if you read those tales now, the language is, what's the word? It's antique. And young people would find that quite difficult. So do it again, Michael, I thought. Do it again. Not better, it's not better, but it's a different way and it's in the language of today.
This tale is based on The Taming of the Shrew, which is a play. It's about families, it's about love, and it's about relationships. There are lots of different ways always to interpret Shakespeare's plays and characters and stories. My tales from Shakespeare are my idea, my take on these plays and what I think the characters and the stories are like. But you'll have your own ideas. You might even want to write them down. That's what he did. Strange to think of it, but Shakespeare did sit down and just write these by hand. Maybe you could do the same thing.
This is the story of Catherine, who was famous, notorious even, all over the city of Padua for being difficult, temperamental and tempestuous, volcanic sometimes when upset, obstinate and objectionable always, just impossible.
Actually, she was just a young woman with a mind of her own and not shy of being who she was and saying how she felt.
But in those long ago days in Italy, in Padua, women were not supposed to be like that. They were supposed to be meek and mild and obedient and not to have opinions of their own.
Well, Catherine wasn't like that. And she wasn't going to be. No matter what anyone said or society dictated.
And everyone knew it.
You're retelling the tales, but Shakespeare himself was a reteller.
He was a terrible cheat, he was, and just like me. No, I mean, the truth is there are only seven stories in the world, and he pretty well picked all of them, and I've done that a lot as well. And in a sense, anyone who writes a story, you know, of course they're the great people, like Shakespeare, but we mustn't be overwhelmed by reputation, otherwise we start treating it like a sort of gospel, you know, and treating it as if nothing else can be done around it. Actually, what we should do is act it. But if you can't act it, then tell it, you know, and that's all I did.
If you do meet him in another life, do you think he'd be annoyed?
No, he wouldn't. He'd say, you're a copycat, and she's what he was, that's all right. No, I mean, I tell you what the other thing is. The other thing is that the problem with Shakespeare is that people are terribly serious about it, you know? And it's not the hallowed text. No, this is a man of flesh and blood who wrote about flesh and blood people then, and flesh and blood people are roughly the same now. We wear different costumes in a different society, but the same stuff goes on, and it's relevant, and that's why I thought it was worth doing. I think he actually, I don't know, but the kind of human being I imagine he was, I would think he'd say, well, it's really good because I want people to see my plays. I want all the people to see my plays, and he believed in that, you know. I mean, he ran theatres where people went in really cheaply, the groundlings, and they did, they provided quite a lot of the audience reaction, which they loved. So he would have thought, no, yeah, everyone should have this. And anyway, it's our right. It's our cultural right to know Shakespeare. And one of the problems of, I won't speak of Scotland, but I will speak of England, is we have a very divided society educationally. We have those people who go to the theatre, who read books, go to libraries, and we have an awful lot who don't. And the great thing, I think, if we can do it in our schools and our libraries and everywhere, is to reach out to those people who don't necessarily come to this sort of thing easily. Most people, whether they're literary or not in their background, love a good story, you know? And that's what I've tried to do, tell a good story. And then they think, oh, Shakespeare's quite fun. Shakespeare's quite interesting. Cool, even, you know? Now, if you look at the front cover of that book, it's cool. You know, that is a really cool writer having a really interesting look at you and saying, you know, enjoy this. And if you don't enjoy it, I don't care. You know, it's that sort of look in his face, which is great.
Talking of the cover, there's a link to your farm.
There is. Wonderful man who wrote it, I met. He's absolutely incredible. He's huge. And he stood up at some talk I was giving and said, I don't want to ask a question, sir. And I thought it was a bit strange. He said, but when I was 8, I came to your farm. And I worked on the farm for a week, like all the kids did, and he loved it. And I was really moved, because to meet someone all these years later who's gone off and done something remarkable, become this first-rate illustrator, it was a joy to meet him, a real joy to meet him. So it's completely appropriate that he's doing the cover. And he also did the inside illustrations to Macbeth as well, which I know people in Scotland will appreciate.
Now, you've got 10 different illustrators illustrating 10 different stories, and the audiobook carries that on. You've got 10 different actors reading the stories. Did you have any choice in the narrators of the book?
No, it was one that, it's just such a happy accident. There's so much about this book that's a happy accident. It sounds awful. It's also an unhappy accident. I wouldn't have written it if the pandemic hadn't happened. I wouldn't have been searching for a project that I would, that I wanted to find something that would be occupying to my head and emotionally and intellectually as long as possible. And I chose this. I lost myself in this project. A year went by. I hardly noticed the pandemic. And I sort of feel that that kind of immersion was very, very good for me.
She was known everywhere as the shrew. Not that shrews are like this at all.
It's just what a woman is called who had a mind of her own and was thought to be rather feisty, sharp-tongued and argumentative, was called in those days.
Her father, Baptista was his name, was well known in the city and a wealthy man. He had two daughters, Catherine and Bianca. And the time had come to find suitable husbands for both his daughters. But he had a problem. All the eligible young men who came calling at the house were immediately attracted to Bianca, because she was gentle and sweet and pretty.
And, most importantly, compliant.
She would do what she was told. She was just the kind of woman most of these young men were looking to marry. Catherine, the shrew, had this fearsome reputation. She might be beautiful, but she terrified every young man who came to the house. So they all steered well clear of her. None of them wanted a nightmare of a wife like her.
The Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford heard about the project and said, wouldn't it be great if our actors, who are doing nothing because it's the pandemic, could get on the stage and... Well, they'd be involved in the editing of it, too. They went back and forth from Stratford to my house and Stratford to my house. And all the time they were editing and with the story with me and honing it, refining it, until they were happy to get up on stage. And then, of course, they did it. It was the only thing, of course, they did during there were no live action theatres going on. So I think they were very pleased to have the work and to engage with it. And I was very pleased to have... the people that Shakespeare would have worked on his plays with, you know, and there they were doing it and doing it in the very place where he was born and indeed where he's buried.
Well, being an audio version means it's accessible to people for whatever reason can't access print, and you yourself have narrated books. Is that important to you?
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, I love telling stories, telling them loud, you know. I had a bit of a problem when I was a young person with print on the page. I don't know if I was dyslexic. The word wasn't around then. People didn't say anything about it, but I found reading very difficult, particularly when words were closely printed and quite small and there were lots of lines on the page. I would find that very difficult. So I sort of steered away, I think, from the print. And I love my mother reading to me. I love my grandmother reading to me. My aunt is reading to me. And the sad thing is that a lot of children get that, and then they go to school, and all of a sudden... books become something that you study and you have a comprehension about it, and people start using it as text for punctuation and for grammar, and before you know it, they've taken the heart out of it. And I'm very much against that kind of thing, because I think stories are for storytelling. If you've got to write them down, write them down, but they're finally their stories for telling.
And finally, recommend one good audiobook for us. What story should be told out loud?
Well, I mentioned another book, which I think at the present moment is the most important book that's been written. Very few people know about it, but it's a book that I love, but it just happens to be hugely important now. There's a book by a man called Jean Giono called The Man Who Planted Trees, a French book written way back in the 1930s. And it's about an old shepherd who goes up into the mountains each day with his sheep. But he doesn't just do that, he takes a bag of acorns and he starts planting it and planting it. It's a book which occupies 30, 40 years. And in that time, he creates a forest. And with the forest, of course, comes birds. And with the forest comes water. It's about the renewing of the land. It's a hugely important book, and it's very beautifully written, so the telling of it aloud, or reading it aloud, is something I really love to do. It's a book I really want everyone to read. The Man Who Planted Trees. Read it!
About 40 years ago, I went on a long hike through hills absolutely unknown to tourists in that very old region where the Alps penetrate into Provence. This region is bounded to the southeast and south by the middle course of the Durance between Sisteron and Mirabeau, to the north by the upper course of the Drôme from its source down to Die, to the west by the plains of Comtat-Venessin and the outskirts of Mont Ventoux. It includes all the northern part of the département of Basses Alpes, the south of Drôme, and a little enclave of Vaucluse. At the time I undertook my long walk through this deserted region, it consisted of barren and monotonous lands at about 1,200 to 1,300 metres above sea level. Nothing grew there except wild lavender. I was crossing this country at its widest part, and after walking for 3 days, I found myself in the most complete desolation. I was camped next to the skeleton of an abandoned village. I had used the last of my water the day before, and I needed to find more. Even though they were in ruins, these houses, all huddled together and looking like an old wasp's nest, made me think that there must at one time have been a spring or a well there. There was indeed a spring, but it was dry. The 5 or 6 roofless houses, ravaged by sun and wind, and the small chapel with its tumble-down belfry, were arrayed like the houses and chapels of living villages, but all life had disappeared.
That's Malk Williams, reading from The Man Who Planted Trees by Jean Giono, available from RNIB Talking Books, and it runs for a mighty 28 minutes. Also in the RNIB library is Charles and Mary Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare and Michael Morpurgo's Tales from Shakespeare. In fact, a search for Michael Morpurgo in the RNIB library brings up 13 pages of results, so there are many of his books available. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
On today's show, we've had some Christmas books and some brand new books in the library. Well, to end the show, let's combine both. Here are some brand new Christmas books available from RNIB.
Everyone This Christmas Has a Secret, donated by Penguin Random House, is by Benjamin Stevenson.
I didn't know he'd book a magician. It's saying something. Given my recent experiences include the skinning of my right hand and being stabbed in both the stomach and the shoulder, that suggesting my well-meaning but dim-witted Uncle Andy had booked my wedding entertainment might be the thing that led to my demise. Thankfully, a Bluetooth connection and the fact I was driving 100 kilometres an hour away from my fiancée Juliet were keeping me physically safe. I know he means well, Juliet sighed, which made the car's speakers crackle. This is another thing about holiday specials. Sometimes the makers can't afford the whole cast, so several main characters are reduced to voice or pictorial cameos. It doesn't usually apply to books, but here we are. And I want him to be involved,
But couldn't you have given him something a little less crucial than the entertainment? Marcello's not cooking the wedding cake.
Marcello is my stepfather, and cooks about as well as Andy chooses wedding bands.
I thought he'd book a band, I defended. Hell, Rylan Blaze? With a name like that, I thought he had booked a band.
Rylan Blaze was well known enough that Juliet might have caught me out there, had her knowledge of magicians not stopped at Houdini.
I only found out this morning. At which point in our relationship did you think I would enjoy a band called Rylan Blaze at my wedding?
Our wedding, I corrected.
Not if there's a magician.
That'd be the trick then, wouldn't it? The disappearing bride.
My name is Ernest Cunningham. I'm not a detective. I just happen to have a knack for what makes mysteries and murderers tick. I'd hoped this Christmas that any killers out there might be willing to take a break for the holidays. I was wrong. So here I am, backstage at the Christmas show of world-famous magician Rylan Blaze, whose benefactor has just been murdered. From the magician's assistant to the hypnotist, my suspects are all professional tricksters, masters in the art of misdirection. My clues are even more of a mystery. A suspect covered in blood with no memory of how it got there. A murder committed without setting foot inside the room where it happened. An advent calendar, because, you know, it's Christmas. Solving the murder is the only gift I want this year. But can I catch a killer and make it home for Christmas alive?
An hour and a half out of Sydney, and the road had turned from a freeway to a set of hairpins, climbing up to the mountains at an angle that pushed me back against the headrest like an astronaut at takeoff. What have I let you saw Andy in half? I could almost hear her eyes narrow and her nose crinkle in the way they did when she was still trying to pretend to be mad at me.
Acceptable, she said. Where are you driving anyway? Reception's terrible.
I just had to make a quick trip. Ernest, she said, and it was all over. I am cellophane around Juliet. She sees right through me. I have no idea how people have affairs. I promised I'd go watch, I blurted out. This Blaze bloke in the mountains.
The mountains? Which mountains?
Blue Mountains. He's doing a Christmas show out near Katoomba. I was up the climb now. The area was a World Heritage listed national park, and actually a plateau rather than a mountain range. Everything around me had eroded into valleys, waterfalls, and forests. The eponymous blue came from haze that seemed to condense above the treetops, a result of droplets of eucalyptus oil hanging in the air and refracting the light just so. The most famous spot was the Three Sisters, three gigantic rock pillars that stand watching over the valley. People say these pillars have distinct personalities, depending on the time of day, from bright happiness to shadowy glowering. If one were to believe they were women personified, perhaps dusk, when the rocky features were overcast and dour, was when they'd be notified of a magic act at their wedding.
Everyone This Christmas Has a Secret by Benjamin Stevenson is read by Barton Welsh and runs for 5 hours and 3 minutes.
Kiss Me at Christmas is by Jenny Bayliss, donated by Penguin Random House.
Their eyes met through the curls of steam twisting out of their mugs. His were the colour of burned honey, framed by dark eyelashes and sceptical S-shaped eyebrows. Hers were the colour of faded denim, and they watched him with the hunger of an alley cat that's just spied a tasty-looking field mouse. At the other end of the pub, despite only being the third week in November, the Christmas karaoke was in full swing, and the main bar area was swamped with swaying punters trying to cram in another round before the end of happy hour. The smaller bar, in the saloon area, was quieter. Couples cosied up in corners or ate at the candlelit bistro tables.
Will Harriet's heart give in to temptation this Christmas? Whilst her local town explodes in festive cheer from fairy lights to snowflakes, Harriet Smith is determined to hunker down alone, until she spends one magical night with a handsome stranger and dares to wonder, what if? Then Harriet's plans of a quiet Christmas take another turn when the beloved Winter Theatre faces closure. They've no one to direct the annual panto, so Harriet gallantly steps up to the task. Can Harriet save Christmas, even when the man she never thought she'd see again reappears to help with the show? Will the memory of his touch come between them? Or will their undeniable chemistry bring them together to ensure the show goes on?
Her phone rang. Emma. She sucked on the inside of her cheek as she debated taking the call and then decided that she wasn't ready to talk about it yet. If she did, she might cry. And she didn't want to cry. She dismissed the call and buried her phone deep in her handbag. Tonight, she wanted to forget. This was Harriet's second mug of mulled wine, and she was enjoying the taste of cinnamon and star anise and the velvety caress of the hot wine slipping down her throat. The warmth feathered out through her chest in a delicious trickle. The man smiled, and one of those sceptical eyebrows quirked a little higher, giving him serious Jack Nicholson vibes. A delightful zing of excitement ricocheted around inside Harriet's sensible knitted tights. She smiled back in what she hoped was a flirtatious way, and then wider when he began walking toward her. She could do this. It was just like riding a bike, right? Do you mind? He asked, gesturing to the bar stool next to hers. His voice was moody blues and sandpaper. She nodded, and he perched, keeping one foot planted on the sticky carpet. He smelled like sawed pine and cloves. His suit was sharply cut and expensive, the top button of his white shirt undone, tie ever so slightly pulling to the left. He was so good-looking that she had the urge to punch him. This wasn't a normal response, she knew this, but something about this level of attractiveness was sparking a visceral, physical reaction inside her.
Kiss Me at Christmas by Jenny Bayliss is read by Caroline Fantozzi and runs for 11 hours and 24 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. Have a very Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous 2025.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.